welcome to the 3rd of December episode of Civis Pacem Parabellum. My name is Rob Adams. I'm a retired United States Navy Chief Petty Officer, and my oath of enlistment will expire when I do. I am an American, a patriot, and an activist. I am not a Republican, and I'm sure as hell not a Democrat. No political party dictates my vote, nor my thinking. I reserve the right to think for myself. I believe in the saying, "In God I trust, all others verify." As my dad taught me, don't believe everything you hear and only half of what you read. I do not trust anyone that expects to be believed simply because they say something and or they have a bunch of letters behind their name. You can have a PhD and still be a flippin' idiot. I'm more apt to trust someone that provides references to their source material, unless, of course, the facts they are stating are blatantly obvious. You know, sky, blue, water, wet. I believe in critical thinking, not critical race. I believe our rights are given to us by God, not by any government, though historically, governments try to limit or take those God-given rights away. Civis Pacem Parabellum is a Latin adage that means, if you want peace, prepare for war. This implies that a society that is prepared for war will be a deterrent to those wishing to engage in hostilities. In this episode, I'm going to discuss how more people are murdered by tyrannical government actions during peacetime than during wars, and how this smaller number of government operatives is able to kill a vastly superior number of people. Now, in my urgent podcast from a few days ago, I discussed 14 indicators of tyrannical government. Do not intend to say that there are only 14 indicators. Those were simply the ones that I wanted to identify and discuss. And I also provided examples of how that tyranny is in your face right now, today. Not just here in the United States, but around the world. Well, today I'm then going to discuss our Founding Fathers' views on opposing such tyranny, as well as the views of other persons throughout our rich history. I'll follow up in the next episode with the Just War Doctrine and what it may mean to us in the not-so-distant future. Now, the majority of this podcast is based upon or adapted from Resistance to Tyranny, which was published by Joseph P. Martino, Ph.D. And it was published in 2010. In the 5th century, Augustine, the Bishop of Hippo, wrote of the Pax Romana, the Roman peace, "Peace and war had a contest in cruelty, and peace won the prize." Rudolf Rummel of the Political Science Department of the University of Hawaii did a study of both peacetime and wartime deaths by government action during the 20th century, from 1900 to 1990. What he found is really depressing. He found that nearly four times as many people were killed during non-warfare government actions as during actual wars. 119.4 million people were murdered by tyrannical governments during peacetime, while only 35.7 million were killed during wartime. As a per capita breakdown, peacetime, there were 349 people per 100,000 population murdered, versus 22 per 100,000 during wartime. These government killings were by government officials or by the government not stopping the genocide being performed by others. These do not include death sentences carried out for convicted capital criminals. Some examples here include the Turkish massacre of approximately 1,150,000 Armenians from 1915 to 1917. The Soviet Union murdered approximately 50 million of its own citizens. Germany, over 15 million people. Communist China has murdered an estimated 80 million people. Cambodia holds the record as far as a percentage of its own population murdered, with more than one-third of its 7 million population killed by the Khmer Rouge. Cambodia is where the phrase killing fields comes from. So how are a smaller number of government agents able to massacre a superior number of people? Well, it's easy, simple. They disarmed the people first. Before, sometimes long before, these tyrannical governments began their pogroms, they passed laws forbidding citizens to own or possess firearms. They made it difficult for the citizenry to fight back and resist. They instituted a tell-on-your-neighbor policy. Check the history, check my facts. Don't believe it just because I'm saying it. When the roundups, gulags, concentration camps, and death camps started, the first victims were political dissidents. Most people think that the Nazis just rounded up and murdered those of the Jewish faith. Not so. The first prisoners taken were political prisoners, or anyone that spoke out against the Nazi regime. The estimated 6 million people of the Jewish faith that were murdered during the Holocaust account for a little less than half of the 15 million people that the Nazis murdered. Already discussed the 14 indicators, but I'm going to touch over them real quick here. Number one, the government will create an atmosphere of crisis so that they can justify the repressive measures upon those governed. Number two, a crime wave. The government may intentionally fail to suppress crime, allowing it to gather steam, using the rising crime level to justify greater and greater restrictions on the law-abiding citizenry. Illegal aliens. The government can use the massive presence of illegals to justify internal passports, movement restrictions, citizenships, etc., etc., etc. Propaganda. This is the one that's killing us. Another way of creating an apparent crisis. Let's look at this moronic variant. I mean the Omicron variant of COVID. According to the doctors treating it in South Africa, where it was found, the cases are mild, nobody's been hospitalized, and you're usually over it in 2 to 3 days. Oh no, the rest of the world is locking down because of it. Creeping denial of rights. Once convinced through propaganda that there is a crisis, people become more willing to have their rights taken away, little by little. The government takes 2 steps forward in removing your rights. They take 1 step back and relax their restrictions. Then they take another 2 steps forward to remove your rights, and then they'll back off 1 step and let you have a little bit more freedom. Number 6, loss of a job. Hey, you got a government contract? Toe the line or else. Number 7, denial of a license or removal. How many doctors and lawyers have lost their license for speaking out against the establishment? False arrest. Well, while not arresting the crime wave, they're arresting those that have committed no real crime on either false or fictitious charges. Dependency on the government. Oh, well, we're going to shut everything down, but here's a stimulus check. We'll give you money. Illegal actions. There's some retaliatory actions that even if the citizen wins in the court, it's going to be so long and drawn out that that poor victim of these illegal actions is now destitute, broke, whatever. Number 11, harassment over environmental regulations. People, this one's coming with this whole climate change nonsense. They can deny you medical care. That's number 12. Number 13, a national ID system. People, the national ID system is already here. You have that little gold star on your driver's license? Guess what? National ID. Infiltration. This has been used by law enforcement, sending people undercover into groups and tearing them apart from the inside. They can send in agent provocateurs that will initiate something, and then the agent provocateurs will disappear into the shadows while everybody else that just tagged along is now facing criminal charges. So I'm not going to go in depth on these. I did that in my Urgent podcast about a week ago. So let's continue on here. The present government in the United States is already practicing the five-step solution to a resistance movement. If you pay attention to what is happening right now in the United States, you can see them. The first step is to identify the resistors, the troublemakers, the influencers or motivational speakers around which an actual resistance may be formed. If you've been paying attention to everything coming across the propaganda networks, MSNBC, CNN, CBS, NBC, all those, they've had the intention of dividing us and pitting us against each other. The DHS came out over this past summer and identified American citizens that are speaking out against, or they're speaking out about election fraud, speaking out against COVID measures. We've been labeled as domestic terrorists. The DOJ has also come out and targeted parents speaking out about against CRT and this transgender brainwashing nonsense going on in our schools. They've labeled them as domestic terrorists. Look at the definition of a domestic terrorist. Look it up on the FBI website. A domestic terrorist is someone who uses violence. How we're doing is speaking out. We have not turned violent. The second step is to marginalize the previously identified individuals or groups. They will use their propaganda machine. I'll tell you what, in the mainstream media nowadays, Joseph Goebbels would be real proud. They use that machine to paint those individuals or groups in an unfavorable light. This is with the intent of leading the public into viewing these individuals or groups as undesirables or extremists. A person exercising their Second Amendment right to self-defense is painted as a white supremacist and a criminal by the mainstream media before ever even going to court, while another individual that shoots some of his classmates on school property is all but excused by the media because he was bullied. And then more facts came out about that one. But that's a different story. The third step is to demonize the above identified and marginalized individuals or groups. Once the propaganda of the media has convinced the public of the individual or the group's extremism, well, it makes it easier for the government to go after them. The public is manipulated to the point of open hatred. The fourth step is persecution. Once those individuals or groups have been demonized, violence against them can be carried out pretty much with impunity. Criminalization of them will lead to aggressive actions by law enforcement. Anyone who attempts to fight these actions on civil rights grounds will be looked at with disdain at the least. Look what is currently happening in Australia, New Zealand, Austria. And what the hell has happened to our own ACLU? They've gone totally woke. Fifth step is extermination. Once the targeted individuals or groups have been sufficiently demonized and the persecution has begun, wholesale extermination can be carried out with little public opposition. Look at history. The Soviet Union, Nazi Germany, Communist China, these are the very visible steps that led to the patricide in those countries. Now look at the United States. What do you see happening here? Election integrity, questioning anything COVID, speaking out against the installed regime, BLM and Antifa. Antifa, oxymoronic name, isn't it? A group claiming to be anti-fascist, but using fascist tactics. In the U.S., marginalization of constitutionalists and conservatives has been going on for a long time. It is just becoming more and more obvious. The American sheeple have been so weakened as to accept unacceptable limits on civil liberties. Most Americans have lost touch with their heritage. As Benjamin Franklin said, they that can give up essential liberty to obtain a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety. I have to concur. Now, our founding fathers had very definite views on how to deal with a tyrannical government. Thomas Jefferson was straight to the point on it. The strongest reason for the people to retain the right to keep and bear arms is, as a last resort, to protect themselves against tyranny in government. Alexander Hamilton, one of the firmest believers in a central form of government, still said, "The best we can hope for concerning the people at large is that they be properly armed." In the Federalist 28, Hamilton also said, "If the representatives of the people betrayed their constituents, there is then no resource left but in the exertion of that original right of self-defense, which is paramount to all forms of government." Do you think our representatives are betraying their constituents? Jefferson also said, "The Constitution of most of our states and of the United States asserts that all power is inherent in the people, that they may exercise it by themselves, that it is their right and duty to be at all times armed, that they are entitled to freedom of person, freedom of religion, freedom of property, and freedom of the press." In other words, governmental power originates in the people, not the government itself. People create governments. Governments don't create people. If it comes to the people versus the government, it is the government that must give way, that the people not only may, but must be armed to keep the government under control. Founding fathers saw the proper role of government as is written in the Declaration of Independence. "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are established among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed." Governments are here to protect people in the peaceful conduct of their lives, not run their lives for them. I'm going to read directly from Resistance to Tyranny, the book I based the majority of this podcast on. "What then, when the state fails to carry out its duty to protect the daily lives and activities of its citizens, or worse yet, actively hinders or opposes those activities and becomes a band of robbers?" The Declaration of Independence goes on to say that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Lincoln offered a similar view. "This country, with its institutions, belongs to the people that inhabit it. Whenever they shall grow weary of the existing government, they can exercise their constitutional right of amending it, or their revolutionary right to dismember or overthrow it." Woodrow Wilson, a Democrat, believe it or not, stated in 1912, "Liberty has never come from the government. Liberty always comes from the subject of it. The history of liberty is a history of resistance." Senator Hubert Humphrey, another liberal Democrat, stated, "Certainly, one of the chief guarantees of freedom under any government, no matter how popular and respected, is the right of the citizen to keep and bear arms. This is not to say firearms should not be carefully used and definite safety rules of precaution should be taught and enforced. But the right of the citizens to bear arms is just one guarantee against arbitrary government and one more safeguard against tyranny, which now seems remote in America, but which has historically proven to be always possible." Damn, what happened to the Democratic Party and half of the Republicans? And that tyranny that he spoke of as being remote, no, it's in our faces today. It is here. Senator Humphrey stated, Well, I just said that. The 17th century English philosopher and physician John Locke wrote, "Whenever the legislators endeavor to take away and destroy the property of the people, or to reduce them to slavery under arbitrary power, they put themselves into a state of war with the people, who are thereupon absolved from any further obedience." Have we not been effectively reduced to slavery under arbitrary power? Taxes, restriction of long-held civil liberties. The government, federal, state, and local, telling us what we are allowed to do, how and when. The Constitution was written not to restrict the people, but to restrict the government. We, the people, have been surrendering our power to the government for decades, and the government has greedily taken it. So it comes down to the question, where do we draw the line? As a collective whole, I have no answer. The creeping denial of rights that I discussed in my previous podcast and mentioned above is designed to be done in such small, incremental steps that by the time we realize that that line has been crossed, it's too late to do anything about it. We will have successfully given up any effective means of resistance. I know where my line is drawn, and it's not drawn in the sand. Mine is carved into the damn bedrock. Lines in sand can be moved much too easily by either side. The book Resistance to Tyranny, as described by the author, is not a handbook for armed resistance. Rather, it is a primer intended to make you aware of questions that you may not have asked before. He asked the questions, but how is that right to defense against tyranny justified, and when can it be exercised? When is actual armed resistance moral? Well, this leads to a discussion on a centuries-old ethical philosophy on the use of force known as the Just War Doctrine. That discussion in my next podcast. Now, don't get me wrong. In this podcast, I am not calling for armed resistance. I'm not telling people to pick up guns and go raid their courthouse. No, 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 no. As I'll explain in the next podcast, we still have legal, peaceful means of resolving what is happening in this country. Not until those are exhausted. Completely exhausted. Do we need to defend ourselves martially? So, no, this is not a call to arms. This is a wake-up call. People, tyranny is here. It is coming at us full bore. There have been several court cases here in the last couple of weeks that have gone in the favor of freedom and liberty. We need to attack this peacefully, legally. I'm not calling anybody to any illegal action, to any violence. I am not for violence. That is a last, very last resort. All right. Till the next podcast. God bless. Stay frosty. Watch your six.